Welcome to Talking Research. I'm Doug Gratz. Thank you so much for listening. Today I'm joined by Dr. Philip Wool, Senior Vice President of Research at Raelient Global Advisors. Phil and his team have done a significant amount of study into the behavioral biases of retail investors. He's here today to share his insights from that research and help us understand why now could be a great time to harvest alpha in emerging market equities. Let's jump right in.
Phil, tell me, what are some of the recognizable biases that retail traders have compared to institutional traders?
Yeah, I think, you know, first we want to define what are we talking about when we speak of a behavioral bias. So, you know, we take it for granted. Humans are just prone to making certain biases when they have decisions in front of them. And we've got lots of empirical evidence in the academic literature, but you can really see this all around you when you're, you know, looking at how other people make decisions, looking at how you make your own decisions. And in most cases, I think if you look at what's behind a decision, there's probably some rule of thumb you're using, and the psychologist would call those heuristics. And those heuristics work really well in most contexts, but when you apply those rules of thumb to complicated financial decisions, they often fail pretty miserably. So that's what we mean when we're talking about a behavioral bias. Now, as economists, we can't usually see into the heads of stock traders to know exactly why they made a particular decision, but sometimes we do see records of their trading activity, or maybe we see the list of stocks that they hold in their portfolio. Sometimes we just see, for every stock in the market, how many shares of that stock are held by retail investors. And so we can look for a bias by comparing what we've observed there to some model for rational behavior. Most of the time, we're not really observing the bias itself. We're really just seeing the retail investors' preferences by looking at, for example, portfolio holdings. And then we would try to associate some pattern in those preferences with this wide range of biases that psychologists identified. Now, the question specifically was about the difference in bias between retail investors and professional investors. We're mostly concerned with retail investors who are buying stocks for themselves. When they invest in a fund, you know, they're sort of delegating the decision about, you know, all these investment decisions where their bias would usually hurt them. They're delegating those decisions to a professional. And so we're, you know, those professionals might make some mistakes, but we're mostly thinking about the mistakes that retail investors make themselves, the individual investors, mom and pop investors. And I think in most cases, we would just conclude that retail investors exhibit much more pronounced bias than professional investors, which probably makes intuitive sense when you think that most professional investors have had training. They might have taken an MBA class where they explicitly studied behavioral bias, and they're being paid lots of good money to recognize when these rules of thumb that they would typically use to make a decision are going to fail, and to suppress those bad behaviors. Of course, nobody's perfect, so professional investors make mistakes as well. And I think, incidentally, that's probably a benefit of quantitative systematic investing, because discipline is almost implicitly imposed on the investment process.
Okay, so in terms of making investment decisions, what are some of those behavioral biases that retail traders have that really affect those investment decisions?
Yeah, as I mentioned, that psychologists have a range of these biases that they mention in their research. So they talk about things like representativeness and the availability bias. They talk about the disposition effect, and the list just goes on and on. It might be easier to think about this from a different perspective. We could ask the question, what do we actually observe in terms of outcome of investor bias decisions? And practically speaking, what we're trying to do is look at retail investors' portfolios, and it turns out to be revealing about their preferences, like I mentioned before. And then we can think about how we might want to position ourselves to reap benefits of those errors in judgment. So when you look at retail investors' portfolio holdings, you could take China as an example, because we know there are plenty of retail investors in China, you start to see patterns emerge. For example, you'll see that Chinese retail investors tend to load up on growth stocks. They buy sexy, glamorous companies, companies that don't have any profits, but they've got exciting stories about where all the future profits are going to come from. And these retail investors would buy these stocks without any consideration for how high the valuation of these companies is. You'll also find that retail investors in China prefer stocks with low prices, high volatility. It's even better if the high volatility comes from highly skewed returns. And you can think about these kind of like financial lottery tickets. They're cheap to buy. They give investors a dream of some massive payout, even if they might not be good investments on average. And I think lottery stocks really get to the point that in many cases, retail investors seem to be getting some pleasure out of the activity of investing itself. So it's really more a form of entertainment for them. It's sort of like recreational gambling than it is solely about making well-researched, profit-maximizing investments. And in China, you'll see that stock trading is actually a very social activity. People go and hang out at the brokerage hall. People actively microblog and post messages on message boards about their trades. So you can imagine when you're having a good time with this, when it's about recreation, there might be less concern in terms of avoiding bias, and that's just going to exacerbate all of this issue that we're talking about. And I think the last point in terms of bias that affects decision making, you know, we can think about these specific behavioral biases that psychologists talk about, but it's also obvious that retail investors lack the training. You know, they're not putting necessarily the required amount of work into the research that they're doing. And so it wouldn't be surprising that they misprice companies in terms of more nuanced concepts. So you can imagine earnings quality, which can be quantitatively assessed, or precise estimation of companies' default risk. You could add to this list of specific biases that I mentioned before some very general shortcomings, like, you know, doing shallow research or limited attention to relevant information. And then you'd get a more complete picture of where retail investors are frequently going to stumble when they try to trade by themselves.
Okay, so if these retail traders are making suboptimal investment decisions, do they learn from these mistakes over time? Do we find that these mistakes tend to start becoming less frequent among these people, or is it something more ingrained in their behavior?
That's a great question, and it's something that psychologists, long before behavioral finance existed, psychologists in the early 1960s were very concerned with studying how people learned. And one of their findings that's relevant to this question of, you know, why retail investors might or might not learn is related to overconfidence. This is just the fact that people place way too much weight on their skills than would be warranted by the evidence. And overconfidence is the reason, you know, you see these surveys, 90% of drivers think that they're above median, which is clearly impossible. With respect to trading, overconfidence means that investors, retail investors, are going to enter the game thinking they know more than everyone else. And that leads them to ignore, or at least heavily underweight, any information that would lead them to make better investment decisions. So they play the game a few rounds, and like you said, they're going to make suboptimal decisions. They're eventually going to start to see some of the mistakes. And so the question related to learning would be, would they learn from those mistakes? Once again, I think overconfidence is at play. This time it's in the form of something that psychologists refer to as biased self-attribution. And this is just a technical term for this notion that if I won, it must be skill, but if I lost, it's just bad luck. And so if I blame all of my failures on chance, then I'm probably going to keep making the same mistakes over and over again. Now, some studies have observed learning by investors, but even in those cases, researchers ask further, do investors learn optimally? Or is the way in which they're actually incorporating their past experience into future behavior, is that hurting them somehow? So there's an interesting study that was done in Taiwan, and these researchers looked at the way investors learn from past participation in IPO auctions. And what the authors found was that retail investors did seem to learn from past experience. So if they made money in the first IPO that they purchased, then they were more likely to participate in future IPOs. And if they lost money, they'd typically call it quits and they just avoided future deals. But when the authors dug deeper, what they found was that this learning was actually harming the investors, because they would be more likely to participate in IPOs if they had a win in their first deal, but they became much worse at choosing between good and bad IPOs. So if they had an initial success, they would just pursue all IPOs regardless of quality. And they also became more aggressive in their bidding. So on future deals, they were more likely to overpay for the stock. Now, this study is really interesting because not only did they have data on retail investors' participation, they also looked at professional investors. And they found that professional investors were also more likely to participate in future deals if they succeeded early on. But they found that institutional investors, over time, they would actually improve in terms of picking the right IPOs and also in terms of optimizing their bidding strategies so they didn't overpay. Now, last point I'll make on this, on top of all of this I've just said about learning, we should also consider, one, learning can take a long time, especially in securities markets where stock returns are really volatile and it's hard to know with any confidence whether you actually made a mistake or not. And then the second point is, in some emerging markets like China, there have been many retail investors flooding into the market, and all of those investors presumably are starting at square one in terms of their financial knowledge and in terms of this sort of learning from mistakes. So even if learning's going on, we might not observe it just because you've got many new generations of investors constantly entering the market.
Gotcha. Many of the examples that you've used to describe retail behavior have been in China and the emerging markets. Is retail trading behavior different in the developed markets versus the emerging markets? And in what areas is it similar?
That's a good question. I reference studies in China and Taiwan. So, you know, clearly research has been done in emerging markets on investor behavior. There's been research all over the world, in the US as well. And one of the findings that comes out of cross-country research when you start looking at how preferences look across the world is that retail investors actually show many of the same leanings in terms of which stocks they tend to prefer wherever we go around the globe. We found that Chinese retail investors tend to go after glamour stocks and high-risk lottery stocks. The same applies to individual investors in the US. They typically load up on those same characteristics. And I think the implication is just that human beings are sort of wired the same way in terms of these heuristics they're using, and it's going to lead to the same sorts of mistakes when they try to apply those rules of thumb to trading stocks. In a practical sense, I would say this is quite convenient for us because it means that when we start thinking about how we're going to take advantage of mispricings that result from all these biases, we won't necessarily have to go back to the drawing board in terms of what investor behavior looks like in each different place and how that affects stock prices and then, you know, how we should trade to exploit that.
Right. Well, now, during periods of exuberant market periods, we tend to see that the momentum factor is something that really drives the market. Do we see that same kind of momentum behavior in markets dominated by retail traders?
Yes. So momentum, this idea in the U.S., for example, winning stocks, they tend to keep winning, losing stocks tend to keep losing. Momentum turns out to be an interesting case because it's kind of like a caveat to what I've just said about investor behavior being fairly consistent when you look across countries. Psychologists and behavioral finance researchers, they've implicated many causes for this momentum effect, things like overconfidence, which we talked about a minute ago, prospect theory, and there are plenty of other theories as to why investor behavior would lead to momentum. When we look for evidence of momentum in emerging markets, we know there's high retail participation. The behavioral bias that might cause momentum should be more pronounced in those markets. But in many emerging markets, momentum just doesn't exist, particularly in Asian emerging markets like China, South Korea, Taiwan. One possible explanation in China that's been put forth that might have some merit for the absence of momentum is the speed at which Chinese investors trade stocks. The idea here is that trading is just happening too fast for one to observe 12-month momentum. That's the version that the US academic literature cites, and it's the version that you'd most often see in financial products. So trading's just happening too fast for that 12-month momentum to ever develop. If we looked closer at what trading looks like, what retail investor trading looks like in China, we'd see often it comes in the form of day trading on mobile devices, on computer terminals at public trading rooms. And empirically, we know when we look at data on retail investor trading in China, they tend to turn their portfolios over about four times as fast as U.S. retail investors, and they hold fewer stocks. They hold about 2.5 stocks on average at any one point in time. And this suggests that with this rapid fire trading, holding just a few positions and constantly moving into the next big rumor, we wouldn't observe momentum at long horizons. Maybe at very short horizons like intraday, you would still see momentum in some of these emerging markets, but month to month, year to year, you wouldn't see this familiar pattern of overreaction over a long period and then suddenly a reversal like we do in U.S. markets. And the general takeaway is that momentum fails in Asian emerging markets, even though there seem to be common psychological bias across markets. So there are other aspects of behavior distinct from these kind of ingrained biases, like the way stocks are traded in different places or the way trading is structured in terms of market regulations, that could lead to different manifestations of the same bias depending on where we look.
Gotcha. Okay. So having a better understanding of behavioral biases of retail traders, how can you better construct a market portfolio so that you can capitalize on some of the retail trader shortfall?
Great. Yeah, this is where it comes in really handy, this perspective that we're going to look at which characteristics retail investors tend to favor, possibly as a result of their bias. So the notion here is theoretically, retail investors have irrationally high demand for certain characteristics like growth or like high risk. They're going to bid the prices for those stocks too high, such that we want to underweight or even drop those stocks from our portfolios completely. If retail investors shun boring value stocks, then that lack of demand is going to lead to undervaluation. And then we might want to add those stocks to our portfolio. So part of our strategy would just entail trying to do the opposite of whatever these psychologically biased retail investors are doing. And then I would say the other component of that strategy, and I alluded to this before, might be thinking about the things that retail investors aren't doing in terms of their research. So if they don't pay attention to the quality of firms' reported earnings, then that information won't necessarily get into the price of those stocks. And we can check any information that they're ignoring or trading on to create mispricings as a result of, you know, lack of attention to those factors. Those are the sorts of things that we should be doing as professional investors to exploit the mispricings that these investors create.
In what markets, which markets around the world do we find the greater percentage of daily trades being done by retail traders?
So I think, you know, I've just described how we might take advantage of these mispricings. When you see mispricings like that, you become attracted to that market. And so over time, you'd kind of expect when their inefficiency is going to attract a lot more professional investors to the market, and then that alpha disappears. So clearly, you know, we want to be trading in places where there are more retail investors and fewer professional investors. When you trade in the U.S., it's almost certainly the case that 90% of investors in the market are professional institutions. So it's much more likely when you submit a trade in the United States, the counterparty to that trade is a wise guy, knows much more than you do about the correct price for the stock that you're trading. And we know that outperformance is zero-sum game, so if everyone's a professional, it's much harder to see where our profits are supposed to be coming from. In emerging markets, the balance tips almost completely in the other direction. So in China, for example, number of shares held by professional fund managers has increased in recent years, but it's still the case that when you look at trading volume, 80 to 90% or more of the trading volume comes from retail investor trading. So that means that, you know, based on what I've just described, EM offers a much larger relative pool of alpha for us to tap if we want to use this rational approach targeted at exploiting these mispricings.
Yeah. Well, is it expected that as markets become more developed over time that the percentage of retail trades will become reduced compared to the amount of institutional trades in the markets?
Yes, I do think that's right. So I mentioned, you know, if there's huge alpha in a particular market, it's going to attract lots of sophisticated investors, and they're going to trade away the mispricing that created that alpha. On top of that, we know that the markets themselves are going to change over time. They're called emerging markets, but eventually we think they're going to mature. Things like, you know, improve regulation so that everyone is better informed at the same time. This would be like regulation FD in the United States, better accounting rules like China's convergence to international financial reporting standards mean that there's maybe less ambiguity in companies' financials. And so there's a long list of changes that would take place. All of these factors would theoretically lead to attenuation of the alpha in emerging markets over time. Now, in terms of the percentage of retail investors trading in EM, we can actually look at how things have changed over time because we have data on those trading activities. So when we look at exactly what I've described, you know, retail investors are gradually making way for institutional investors as these markets develop. Just to think about a few cases, in the U.S., in the early 1960s, almost 70% of trading volume was retail. In the last 50 years, that's declined gradually to about 5% today by some estimates. In South Korea, retail trading at year 2000 was around 75% of all trading. Today, it's closer to 45%, which is still high, but you know, quite a bit off of those big numbers you saw at the turn of the century. Now, these changes are often gradual. Sometimes we even see blips in the evolution of retail trading that go against the trend that I've just discussed. So in China, for example, changes in wealth, loosening regulations, new technologies to give people access to trading markets on their mobile phone, all those things resulted in the number of retail brokerage accounts actually tripling over the last 10 years. So it's not always the case that over time retail investor participation is declining. And I think the last caveat here is that even in markets with little retail trading, quantitative strategies still tend to produce alpha because, as I mentioned at the outset, you know, professional investors aren't perfect. They still make mistakes as well. So the future isn't hopeless in terms of the development of these emerging markets. But I would say it's probably still advisable to be an early mover when it comes to exploiting the alpha opportunity in EM. And I think, you know, the last point is the current conditions make it a lot of fun to do research in this area. And so that's one of the things that drives the research group and, you know, strategy development at Railient.
Well, it certainly looks that while some of these markets are dominated by retail traders, there's some tremendous opportunity for institutions to take advantage of the opportunities that those present. So, Phil, thank you so much for the commentary.
My pleasure. Thanks, Doug.